Welcome to Currents, a Norton Rose Fulbright podcast dedicated to project finance trends. I'm Todd Alexander, your host and a partner in Norton Rose Fulbright's New York office. In today's episode, it is my pleasure to have as our guest Steve Greenwald, who is someone that I've known professionally for more than 15 years, a longtime friend of Chad Bornin Park and now Norton Rose Fulbright, currently a senior advisor at Credit Suisse, and formerly, when I first came to know him, was head of project finance for Credit Suisse. I coaxed Steve into sitting down to record with us today after listening to him give his credentials during a recent conference call we were on for a deal on which we are both currently working. After listening to him regale us with some stories from his career and reflecting on how much he has seen, I thought he'd make a great guest. So, Steve, welcome. Now the pressure's on, and hopefully you don't prove me wrong here.
All right.
In today's episode, we're planning to cover a few different topics. I'd like to discuss the advantages of engaging an investment banker, the services an investment banker actually provides, because a lot of time clients come to me and say, do I really need an investment banker or can I do this on my own? And for those in the audience who are both younger than us and are looking at career choices, what it's like to actually be an investment banker. So thanks again, Steve, for sitting down with us. And let's just dive in. So first, you know, one thing, as I was talking about, we were on a conference call a couple weeks ago, and you were telling somebody about how long you've been doing this. So admit here, how long have you been doing this?
Actually, next week, it will be 39 years since I joined First Boston. That was in September of 79. And so I've lived through all the name changes, going from First Boston to CS First Boston to Credit Suisse First Boston, and I guess for about the last 20 years it's been Credit Suisse. So that's my entire investment banking career. It's all been here at this firm, and I've enjoyed it.
I mean, did you want to be an investment banker? You know, I mean, now probably when you went into it, that was before like the movie Wall Street.
It was
before all that heyday of people talking about being an investor. But but what you know, when you were in school, did you want to be an investment banker, or you just, this was the only place that gave you a job out of college?
I never thought about being an investment banker. My image of investment banking was that you had to have a Harvard MBA or the equivalent, and I did not have that. And that you worked ridiculously crazy hours and did ridiculous amounts of travel. And I didn't want that. I never really thought about being an investment banker. And I guess my entry into this world was a rather unusual one. I started out life, I graduated from college up in Buffalo in 1970, and I went into computer systems work. I was doing something that was called computer time sharing back then, which actually has come full circle. Today people call it cloud computing, but it was really a form of cloud computing, and I was writing applications for various types of enterprises using Fortran back then, which was primarily a scientific language, but I became pretty adept at writing financial models using Fortran and other very specialized computer packages for computer time sharing. So I was writing models in the early 70s. I had a few jobs at some computer time sharing service bureaus, including General Electric, including a company called Timeshare. Timeshare was huge. And then in 1973, I took a job in computer systems, again, doing the same type of work, doing time sharing modeling primarily, for Merrill Lynch, nothing to do with the investment bank, although I had some interaction with them. I was in the systems department at Merrill. A couple of years later, I moved to what I think became my fourth job in about 6 years, and I moved over to American Express to do financial modeling and management science, and I actually began to head up American Express's timesharing usage. They were a huge consumer of timesharing. And this was in 1975, 1976. And then after a couple of years, I decided I didn't want to know anything about computers. I wanted to be a finance guy. I made a very conscious decision that I didn't want to be the computer nerd. And so I went into finance, or what they called finance. It was really more budgeting and almost accounting-oriented type of work. But I did that, and out of the blue, I got a call from a headhunter about a position taking me back to computer modeling for First Boston. And that was really the first time I ever had to contemplate what it might be like to work at an investment bank. And I guess I should have realized something when they told me that I could have the interview after work at 5:30. Remember, work was till 5 o'clock when I was at American Express. So here I go down to First Boston's offices at the 20 Exchange Place, and it is 5:30, and the place is hopping. And I was shocked to see so many people there. And anyway, I had the interview. I met with a bunch of folks there. And the next day, I got the offer. The guy who was running Project Finance was a fellow named Ted Fowler. He went on, actually, to run investment banking at First Boston in the 80s. But Ted gave me an offer the next day. And I started on September 26th, 1979. I didn't even know the title that I would have when I came in, but I learned after I was hired that I would be an analyst. I didn't really know what that meant, but I learned pretty quickly that I was 31 and most of the analysts were about 10 years younger. And I was a little bit concerned with that, although the money looked to be pretty good. And I told some friends that I'm making this jump from American Express because, quote, I am told that investment banking can be lucrative. And so here I was at First Boston and an analyst in the latter part of 1979. And then in January, I got promoted to an associate. And I think it was a year or 2 years later, I just don't recall, I became vice president. And so it was a very rapid rise, but I started when I was much older than any of the analysts really in the group. But I started out doing financial modeling for the Project Finance group before there were PCs. So I kind of went back. It's true. But the earliest PCs really that firms started using was probably around 83, 84. But here I was in 1979 going back to doing the financial modeling that I tried to get away from at American Express. And these guys thought I walked on water because I knew how to use certain computer time-sharing packages that enabled them to turn models around, that enabled me, really, to turn models around very, 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 very quickly. So instead of giving it to the systems department, which had been the approach, they would give something to the systems department, and 3 or 4 weeks later, they would get a model back, and then if they wanted to change the debt structure, a week later, they would get the model back. And here I was able to put together these models in basically a couple of days, 2-3 days, and if they wanted to change something, I'd come back in 2 or 3 hours. And as I said, they thought I was the second coming, when really all I was doing was using computer timesharing models that I was familiar with, but that the firm hadn't been using, that the firm just didn't really work that way. So that's how I got into the business. I got into it doing modeling, learning the numbers, learning how to read balance sheets and cash flow statements, and that's how it all started.
So what, you know, once we got PCs, what was the secret to your longevity? You know, investment banking is famous for having a very short shelf life. Every time there's a, you know, downturn in the economy, you always, you know, hear about the dads picking up, or in this case, not dads only anymore, dads and moms picking up their kids in the middle of the day from school because of all these investment in their suits because all the investment bankers are out of work. You know, what do you attribute your longevity to?
Yeah, well, I mean, sometimes I glibly say I couldn't find another job. I was actually offered a spot in M&A here, or someone asked me if I would consider jumping from Project Finance to M&A. And back then, First Boston had truly the, or certainly one of the premier M&A departments. It was headed up by Joe Perella and Bruce Wasserstein. And I also saw how those guys worked. Those guys were literally 24/7. On call, and it's not something that I really wanted to do. The nice thing about Project Finance was that while it can get very hectic at certain times, usually projects are of such a long-term nature in the development process that very few things really had to be done yesterday. But there were crunch periods, and for those reasons, really, I stayed in project finance, and I loved the work. And as I said, I stayed here because the firm was good to me. There was a point in the early 90s when I was wooed by actually two other firms, and I seriously considered making a jump. And I actually didn't think at that time I would ever make managing director here. And so I was receptive to outside offers. I was told unequivocally when I showed them the offer that I would make MD, and of course I did, and I ultimately came to run the group. So things actually worked out for me quite well here. But I like it here. I'm very comfortable. I like project finance. I still like project finance.
So now that you got computers and email and you've seen it all from, I guess, probably from telex to fax to whatever.
Maybe not telex, but certainly fax.
Morse code, but so how has the business changed? I mean, I'm sure just the pace has changed, right? Because even in my career, you can see everybody's carrying around a computer in their pocket now. How just has the type of work you do and the pace at which it's done changed over the last...
The biggest thing, of course, is the PC. That's right. I mean, when I was in the group in the late 70s, early 80s, I was the only guy doing modeling for what was then about a 12-person project finance group. And so I would be working on 6 or 7 projects at a time, typically. I loved it, and I loved the fact that they relied on me to do it. Today, every analyst that we hire has the same, basically, skill set that I had back then, because everyone knows Excel, and everyone can write the same model that I wrote using Excel. I think that the biggest change that I've seen is an attempt, and I guess this is a critique, is an attempt to put so much precision into these models, yet that precision just isn't really there. So, I laugh when I see models come out going out 15 or 20 years and it's down to the last dollar. I say, I don't want to see, $124,613.27. I want to see, $123 million is fine.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
And so I think people are going, tend to go a little overboard, especially if they're new to this, in trying to exact precision when you really can't. But overall, I think just the ability to have so many people produce these models and change the models is probably one of the bigger changes that I've seen in investment banking for project finance. The other thing, frankly, is that when I started doing project finance, there were very few people that knew what project finance was. Today, everyone knows what project finance is. And so the types of assignments that we get today tend to be different than the kinds of assignments we would have gotten 25 or 35
years
ago.
In what way? What do you mean by different?
Well, back then, most of the assignments that we had were advisory in nature. No one expected First Boston to lend money. And even in the early days after the merger with Credit Suisse in the late 90s, for a while we were a serious lender. But even back then, it wasn't necessarily critical that we lend money. People were looking for real advice on project finance, and I was one of, a handful or two of people spread across several firms who knew something about project finance. Today, largely because of the IPP revolution in the 80s and 90s, you have dozens of people, if not hundreds of people, that know something about project finance. They probably know as much today as I knew back in the early 80s, but they know enough that they at least think, in many cases they're right, but not always, that they actually think they don't need advice from the investment banker and they could do it on their own. And I dare say that for people who are doing traditional bank financings and have done three or four of them before, there's no reason for them to hire an investment bank. But back in the early 80s when I started, we were getting hired to advise companies on how to deal with commercial banks who were doing project financing, because we knew something about project financing and our clients really didn't. Today, there are fewer clients that don't know something about project financing.
So let's transition to that. You know, if I'm a client or a potential client of yours sitting out there, you know, give me your best elevator pitch. Who's the type of client that needs an investment banker? What type of services can you provide? Where do you really add value?
Yeah. Okay. All right. If a client hasn't done project financing before, or a client maybe has only done one or two bank deals and they're really not sure how to execute this next project, I think hiring an investment banker makes a lot of sense. I mean, a good investment banker should be pretty agnostic as to the market that the project goes into. Look, the commercial banking market has clearly dominated project finance for the last 35 years. I think it'll continue to do so despite the many pronouncements I've seen in the past that said this is going to be the demise of the commercial banks because of regulation. The banks are always there, and they are really best equipped to do most project financings. I think that because of the rise of the capital markets, and I would include the long-term investment-grade debt product, as well as the high-yield term loans, Term Loan B, even just traditional high-yield debt. There are other markets to consider for certain projects. If a client is just not sure as to which market he should access, hiring an investment banker makes a lot of sense. So, most of our recent transactions are with clients who just haven't really done it before. And they trust us and to work with them on accessing whatever the best market is to bring their deal to financial close.
So what do you see as the future then, as the market, the path gets more well-tread for projects and people, the information's more dispersed and the more concentrated it is where there are bigger players doing deals over and over, does that mean that the role for the investment banker is getting more and more narrow where they're really adding value? Or do
sure.
you think that
No, that's absolutely the case. There are simply fewer deals out there that really require an investment banker to help the client bring a deal to fruition. In the power sector, I was fortunate enough to work on the very first solar deal to get done in the capital markets. It was with FPL at the time. I think it was about a dozen years ago. And we spent a lot of time with FPL and the rating agencies, acquainting the rating agencies with how to look at wind. Working with the agencies, either things that were new at that time to the folks at FPL, NextEra. Today, they've done more project financings in the last, 10 years than I've done in the last 10 years. And so there's no reason for them necessarily to hire an investment banker, unless they're specifically going maybe for a capital markets transaction where the banker might do a private placement for them or just do a traditional 144A capital markets deal for them. But if they're doing a bank deal, they've got their banking relationships, they know what to look for in a bank deal. There's no need for the investment banker.
You talked about FPL or NextEra. Maybe you can tell us a few of your either stories or favorite deals that you've worked on over your long career here.
Yeah, I guess the deals that I've had the most fun on, I think some of it might be a product of how old I was at the time, because things look differently, as you look back and at the time. My earliest deals when I first joined the firm, I did several in Australia back in the early 80s. I like to tell people that I made 16 trips in 22 months from New York to Australia, most of them into Melbourne, but a bunch into Perth and Brisbane. I guess one of the most fun deals that I ever worked on was the Argyle Diamond financing for what was then CRA. CRA is now part of RTZ, the huge London-based mining house. That was just a load of fun because my dad was in the jewelry business, so I knew a little something about diamonds. And I had read about the diamond market, and in fact, one of the individuals in one of the books I read was a personal friend of my father, and we got to see his vault. And I did, which is true. It is a true story. It was so working on the Argyle Diamond Project for me, on a personal level, was immensely rewarding. It was a lot of fun, understanding. The Boston Consulting Group, BCG, had put together a report on diamond pricing, and this was back in 1982 or 83. And we took that report, and with that report, we had to convince lenders that this diamond mine was going to make sense. It was the first of a kind. That was a huge amount of fun. A couple of years later, I got to work on what was the first project finance deal ever attempted in China. We were the advisor to Occidental Petroleum, Arm & Hammer. On their coal mine financing in Shaanxi province in the middle of China. So this was 1984 to 86. The deal closed in 86. We had our closing dinner in the Great Hall of the People. These were the days when there were no cars in Beijing. You couldn't get a hotel in Beijing. Everyone was wearing Mao jackets. But I still have the picture. In fact, after this podcast, I'll show it to you. It's over there. Of the we have the group picture with Deng Xiaoping.
Oh wow!
Yeah. And the fellow who was actually day to day on the project for Deng was a fellow by the name of Li Peng. Now Li Peng was a Russian trained engineer, and that's why he was on the project. So he was basically Arm & Hammer's go to guy to make sure the project got done. Li Peng, though, was known for a rather infamous incident. He was actually premier during Tiananmen Square about 5 years after this deal closed. But we actually spent a lot of time with Li Peng. Never had any inkling he would quite end up where he did. But that transaction was certainly a fabulous one to work on. I mean, since then, I've been fortunate. We were the advisor to Petrobras on the Bolivia-Brazil gas pipeline. We advised ConocoPhillips on their huge heavy oil project in Venezuela, the Petrozuata project. And then domestically, I would include those first-of-a-kind wind and solar deals we did for NextEra. More recently, we got to work on the Freeport LNG project. I was fortunate to work on Ras Laffan, on several of those Ras Laffan financings. We were advisor to Shell and the Japanese on the Sakhalin LNG financing. So I've had a very varied career in terms of the types of projects I've worked on, and I'm thrilled to have been able to do that.
So looking back on all these deals, what type of advice would you have people in terms of mistakes to avoid, your clients, what do you think is like the most common or easiest mistakes that people should avoid?
Well, I think clients should really, really assess what they know and what they don't know. And by the way, this is not just for clients, I think this is for bankers as well. It's very hard for a lot of people to admit that they don't know something. And what I tell young investment bankers that come through here, I say if a client asks you a question and you don't know the answer, don't fudge it. I had a mentor in my very, very first job, actually, who gave me a great line to use, and I've used it for the last 40 years, 45 years, and that is if a client says something to which you don't know the answer, simply say, "That's a great question. I'm going to get back to you on that. It's too important. Yeah, I'm just not 100% sure of the answer. I think I know the answer, but I want to get back to you on that. That's a great question." And I think the client will respect you for it. I think where clients go wrong is when they can't see themselves sometimes that they don't necessarily know everything. And And that happens, you know, from time to time. I mean, most clients are pretty savvy, I think. But sometimes they think they know more than they really do.
Okay, last question for you. Did you ask your or advise your kids to go into this business? And I guess now you have grandkids, huh?
Yeah.
Would you want your grandkids to go into this someday when your grandkids listen to this podcast?
Right.
You know, should your grandkid listen to this and say, you know, I want to go be an investment banker?
Well, my kids never considered it. My two daughters never considered it. So it was not even a discussion with them. The finance was the farthest thing from their mind. Although my younger daughter ended up getting her MBA from Fuqua, but she didn't want to go near finance. She did it in marketing, and she's still actually in marketing. She's working for a startup tech company as the chief marketing officer. But for grandkids, if they showed an inclination for it, I wouldn't discourage them from going into banking or investment banking. I mean, I think you get a great education if you come in as an analyst into any of the banks. You get to work on very meaningful projects, whether you're doing project finance or M&A or raising equity or debt for corporate clients. You get to deal with some very, very, very smart people, and there's certainly nothing wrong with that. And I would just tell them to try to maintain that old, life-work balance as best they could. I mean, I've done it, and maybe I did it because I was the first guy that was doing modeling, and they kind of left me alone to, if I wanted to go home at 6 o'clock, I just did it. You know, if you can maintain the work-life balance, and it can be rewarding, not just financially, but intellectually as well.
All right, Steve, thanks for letting us stop by your office today.
That's great. Enjoy talking.
You can find us online or send us an email at currents@nortonrosefulbright.com. Please rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes or your preferred podcast app. Our show today was produced by Emily Rogers, and I'm Todd Alexander. Stay ahead of the currents.